I'm somewhat disappointed to hear that some of you will not have a paper, because I was looking forward to assigning you something like a 50-page paper with 100 footnotes, but that joy has been taken from me. So instead, I will ask your attention as I tell you about some of my studies. So those of you are free not to take notes. The subject is the nature of consciousness in the Upanishads. And I feel drawn to tell you about this because I feel that when the historian of the next century comes to examine the cultural trends of our time, surely the remarkable rise that we have seen in our own time, this interest of spirituality within the past few decades, will be regarded as an identifiable phenomenon. And this interest in spirituality hasn't been limited to the traditions in our own cultures, but to those of other cultures. And if we are tracing the spiritual history of humanity, I think a starting point certainly must begin with the Upanishads. Certainly religious texts existed before the Upanishads, such as the Vedas of India, the pyramid text of Egypt, the Gilgamesh of Sumeria, Genesis, the Hebrews. But Upanishadic literature introduces a new philosophic spirit. The older religious texts sought to barter with God, as if the aspirant was saying, "I will sing thy praises and tell thee how wonderful you are, and in turn you will give me cattle and handsome sons and victory in battle." But the Upanishads, as I say, give us something different. They give us a new spirit. And to understand the significance fully, we must know something of the history of the period where they merged. Until the 1920s, it was generally believed among academics, among scholars, that the ancient Aryans who invaded North India some 4,000 years ago brought with them civilization and to the aboriginal tribes that they found there. But we now know that there existed in that area, in North India, a vast empire. And only in about the 1920s did excavation really begin in this area known as the Indus Valley. And because most of the sites were along the Indus Valley, it was called the Indus Civilization, though more locations have been discovered over a wider area, and it is now known as the Harappan Civilization, after one of the chief towns, Harappa, which is now in what is eastern Pakistan. But although a great deal of archaeological evidence exists for these Harappans, their language remains a mystery to us, because the script is only preserved on very small seals that they used in their day-to-day transactions. Some scholars have suggested that this language is related to the Dravidian languages of South India, because there is an isolated pocket in the north called Brahui, which interestingly is a cognate of Finnish. The Harappans were a wonderfully diverse culture for its time. These towns had a multi-ethnic population. The sculptures that have survived somewhat rival Greece and are somewhat akin to our own modern art. The towns were laid out in well-defined grids, as you would find in our modern cities. If those of you are familiar with some of the older cities, say even older European cities or even Indian cities, you'll know that there are many curving lanes, and then as the town gets developed, then only will there be town planning in the midst of grids. But as far as they have excavated in these towns as Harappa, Mohenjo-daro, they have found that the city structure has laid out very carefully as a grid work. There was a sewer system throughout the towns. Each house had its own bath, something quite unusual even for modern India. And at the center of each town, there was a large tank, which it is believed that it was used for ritual purification. Though, of course, people in the field of religion who deal with archaeological information try to put a religious spin on everything. It could have just as well been a swimming pool, the town swimming pool, then a ritual purification center. But we know that the administration of these towns were run by priests or religious figures, somewhat akin to, say, the Dalai Lama in Tibet. It was more a religious hierarchy that ran the day-to-day affairs. And by the time that the Aryans came into India, the whole system of this vast Harappan Empire was already in decline. And how much conflict occurred between the two groups is not really known, but the Harappans seemed to be peaceable enough people, and their influence on later Indian history and culture has been stressed by modern Indian historians like the late D.D. Kasambi, who points out that many of the traits that are identified as Hinduism existed as part of the legacy of this earlier group. For instance, the emphasis on a large tank of water before each temple, tree worship, this meditation cult. One of the figures on these small seals that exist show a figure in a meditation posture, in a yoga posture, usually sitting under a tree. And so the Aryans, in turn, who were more of a pastoral people, cattle was an important part of their lives, and their hymns address gods who, in turn, are very important to a nomadic people. They're all mainly atmospheric gods, sky gods. Indra with his thunderbolt, who gives the rain and who is prayed to in times of battle. Varuna, akin to the Greek Uranus, who is the ruler and sits in the highest heaven. The Maruts, who are the wind gods and bring the rains and the thunder and lightning. Agni, the god of fire, who carries the sacrifice to heaven. This ancient way of the Aryans was extremely ritualistic, and the performance of religious rites was required, and in turn featured a number of different priests. There was a priest who performed the material part of the sacrifice, the actual, say, pouring into the fire of the ghee, the clarified butter, one who chanted the hymns, one who recited the solemn sacrificial prayers, and one who was the superintendent of the whole structure, who was known as the Brahmin. And through the performance of this ritual sacrifice, the priest recreated the divine structure. They participated in the creative act. And it is as if the sacrifice itself supported the act of creation, maintained that act of creation, and at the same time gave those who were performing it a certain amount of power. Their religious corpus, as you know, is called the Vedas, the Vedic literature, of which there are four main bodies. The Rig Veda, which deals with the hymns, of which there are about 1,017, and which is divided into 10 books. The Yajurveda, which deals with the ritual sacrifice. The Samaveda, which now deals with way the hymns are to be chanted, the Atharva Veda, which has more to do with the healing of disease, prolongation of life. It is also speculated that there was at one time a fifth Veda called the Ayurveda, of which we only have hints in folklore, and this perhaps was the basis of a lot of the Indic medicines that have come down to us. Each of the four Vedas, in turn, were divided into sections dealing with the mantras, the hymns, the rituals, forest texts, and what is known as the Upanishads. And the Upanishads dealt with a more philosophic way of looking at life and the universe. The word itself is derived from the root sad, with the prefix ni, which means to sit. And Max Müller has suggested that the word originally meant the act of sitting down near a teacher and listening to him, while Paul Dussens notes that the word itself in the Indian context and among Indian scholars is usually used to refer to something secret or esoteric, as in the sense of esoteric instruction or esoteric dialogue, something that is transmitted from mouth to ear. And of course, to hear it mouth to ear, you have to be sitting very close to the person who is transmitting it. The number of Upanishads is estimated to be somewhat over 2,000. Usually classical texts give the number of 108, of which the major 10 have been translated into English. And the date of these major 10 are about 1000 BC to 300 BC. Now, the fundamental idea that runs through the early Upanishads is that underlying the exterior world of change, there is an unchanging reality, which is identified with the ultimate essence of each individual. And the Upanishads, in turn, present us with the history of that quest for the ultimate reality and the results that were achieved. Primary to understanding the Upanishads is the way this quest is undertaken, the nature of our seeking, as it were. And I'll begin by giving you an example from the Chandogya Upanishad, which in its 8th chapter, part 7 to 12, gives an illustration of how the seeking and what happens when one comes. The gods, the devas and asuras, usually asuras are translated as demons, and I feel the asuras have always been given a bad rap because they've always been referred to as the devils or the demons in Indic mythology. But for instance, you have in mythology the example of the asuras and the devas churning the ocean of milk. Both groups were needed to churn this ocean when they were looking for the nectar of immortality. Unfortunately, they used a very large snake which had belonged to Shiva and whose mouth spewed out noxious fumes, of course, in the face of the asuras. So they couldn't be so bad after all. But the gods and the asuras, having heard of this ultimate reality, decided to seek after it, asking themselves, this reality that is free from evil, ageless, deathless, sorrowless. And so they said, come, let us search out that self, the self by searching out whom one attains all worlds and all desires. So Indra, the king of the gods, and Virochana of the Asuras went to Prajapati, the lord of creation, and studied with him for 32 years as his student. And at the end of that time, Prajapati asked them what was their desire, and they asked for the knowledge of that self, the knowledge of self, that ultimate reality. Again, as the text says, which is free from evil, ageless, deathless, sorrowless. And Prajapati, in turn, responds to them, tells them, that person who is seen with the eye, that is the self of whom I spoke, which is immortal and deathless and fearless. And he tells them to look into a vessel of water. What do you see there? That which you see reflected, that is the self. And as the text said, they went with tranquil heart, the two of them. And Virochana went to the asuras and communicated this doctrine to them, that the self that is seen, for instance, in the mirror, this is the ultimate reality, and they ate, drank, and were merry, and of course perished. They went to hell. And the text, of course, comments that those who live for the body eventually perish. But Indra, before he reached the gods, thought about this, and he saw the danger in this, and returned questioning to Prajapati, saying that this self that we see in the mirror, this self, this bodily self that we perceive, that this self, in turn, is liable to illness, to change, to decay. And he declared to Prajapati, I see nothing enjoyable in this. How can this be the ultimate reality when it also decays from its prime and death is all that is ahead of it? So he went back to Prajapati, and Prajapati told him, you spend another 30 years with me and I will answer your question again. And at the end of this time, Indra in turn repeated his question about what is the nature of this ultimate reality? What is the nature of that divine part? And in turn, Prajapati now told him that that which is seen in dreams, that which moves about in dreams, as happy, that is the self. And again, with tranquil heart, Indra, like the good student, accepted his teacher's words and left. But again, before reaching the abode of the gods, he questioned this, noting that the self that is seen in dreams, again, is subject to change, is subject to decay. It is not always in control. It is not always the master of its destiny. And again, we turn to Prajapati, and Prajapati again told him, you stay for another 32 years, which Indra did, somewhat unquestioning after all this time. And after this time was up, Indra again addressed the question about what is it that is the eternal, the divine, that part. And Indra now instructs him that it is the real self, the real true self of the individual is like that which is experienced in dreamless sleep. Again, Indra relieves. Again, he realizes that this self that is like one in dreamless sleep is nothing but a clod of earth, literally dead to the world, and again comes back to Prajapati. And perhaps Prajapati, realizing that he couldn't ask him to stay for another 32 years, said, you stay with me for 5 years this time, and I'll tell you the real story. Like you, it's almost like these cults and gurus. You come back, okay, I'll tell you this. You come back, and I'll tell you a little more. And Indra, devoted as he is, stays. And at the end of the time, he receives the instruction that while the body, the sharira, is mortal, the highest spirit is yoked to it, that one who sees with the divine eye achieves that liberation. So again, the way we approach these texts are very important. We see through this exchange that the student must look for a deeper level. It isn't a question of simply accepting the text, but at least to query the asuras who accepted the easy part, got what they wanted and were happy, but they did not reach that final esoteric level, that level of attainment. And if we are like them, we perish like the asuras. Now this image of the self or consciousness that is yoked to the body emerges throughout the Upanishads, and it comes in very strongly in the Kathopanishad as one of the vidyas that are given. These examples of meditation that are provided throughout the Upanishads, and it's usually a concrete image that is given to the person to dwell upon, to meditate upon, and to ponder over. And here we have the story of Nachiketas, who saw his father bestowing their property to the priest who came in the hopes of attaining prosperity. And his father gave and gave and gave till a few decrepit cows were left. And then finally, so Nachiketas in turn asked his father, well, you've given away almost everything but myself, and to whom will you give me? And he kept nagging his father about this till finally his father said, well, I'll give you, as the text says, I will give you to death. Or in modern translation, the father, after being aggravated, no doubt said, go to hell. Which, again, Nachiketas, being a dutiful son, actually goes to the realm of Yama. He makes this trip to the underworld, and there waits for 3 days on Yama. And this narrative bears a strong resemblance to other tales of the descent, where there is a similar in Mahabharata of Savitri and Satyavan, which I'll give you as a commentary to this descent into the Ashvapati. And she decides to choose a husband. And so she goes looking for an eligible husband, but not finding any to her liking. On her return home, she sees young Satyavan cutting wood, who happens, of course, to be the son of another king who has been deposed, and they're living in the forest. But on her return home, a sage comes to her family and lets her know that, and that on a specific day, he will die. Savitri is undeterred by this and becomes the wife of Satyavan. And when the fateful day approaches, she goes into the woods with him, refusing to leave his side. And as he is cutting wood, he feels this pain, and as he lies down, dies in her arms. And Sri Aurobindo, who has translated this epic into English, gives a really exquisite definition of what happens. As Satyavan is dying in Savitri's arms, he says that Savitri, in turn, then grew aware they were no more alone. Something had come their conscious vast and dire. Near her she felt a silent shade immense, chilling the noon with darkness for its back. An awful hush had fallen upon the place. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beast. A terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. And of course, they are in the presence of Yama, the god of death. But in turn, Savitri refuses to leave her husband and in turn follows Yama, the god of death, for 3 days, clinging to him. And Yama keeps telling her, woman, release this man because you are making him unhappy. He cannot truly go into the underworld which you're consciously holding on to him. So Yama finally gives her, as a boon for her devotion, 3 wishes. And she asks for the sight of her blind father-in-law to be restored, the restoration of his kingdom, and for a century of sons. And Yama grants her these things. But then she says, how can I have a century of sons, 100 children, unless I have it with my own husband? And of course, Yama finally gives in to her devotion and relents and returns Satyavan to her. In fact, the story of Savitri is usually given as the ideal wife who, through devotion, manages to even conquer the august death who no one can in turn conquer. So with Nachiketas, we have the same descent into the underworld, the same 3 days. Those of you who are familiar with the Apostles' Creed realize the 3 days, descended into hell 3 days, and in turn, 3 boons are given to Nachiketas. He asks to be restored to his father. He asks for instruction in the sacrificial ritual that leads to heaven. And then finally he asks this. He says, this doubt exists. Some say when a man dies, he exists. Some say he does not. This I should like to know. Explain it to me. This is my 3rd boon. And Yama replies that even the gods in ancient times doubted this point. It is very subtle and difficult to understand. Do not press me for this boon, but ask for some other. And in turn suggests that wealth offers him a whole array of different earthly rewards. But in turn, Nachiketas again replies that man cannot be satisfied with wealth or enjoy long life after seeing you. That boon alone I chose is what I crave. So finally, Yama reveals to him this mystery. The intelligent soul is not born nor dies. It does not arise from anything. Unborn, eternal, and undecaying. And then gives him this vidya, this mental image for meditation. Know that the Atman, consciousness, sitting within is the master of the chariot which is the body. Know the pure discriminating intellect, buddhi, is to be the charioteer, and the mind as the reins. The senses are called horses, and their sense objects the world. The wise know Atman to be the enjoyer when it is united with the body and the senses united with the mind. Those of you who are familiar with some things of Western Hermeticism know this image of the chariot plays a strong part in a lot of Western Hermeticism. The tarot card is, of course, the chariot. And again, this undecaying consciousness, this higher self, is the master of this chariot, of which the body is that part. The text continues that one whose mind is always unrestrained and has not discrimination, his senses are uncontrollable like the horses of a chariot, which are vicious. But one whose mind is always under control and has correct understanding, his senses are controllable like the horses of a charioteer which are disciplined. He who has no right discrimination, he who is thoughtless, impure, and steady of mind, he never reaches the goal, but moves round the wheel of birth and death. Now, again, these vidyas are tremendously important throughout all these Upanishads. There's somewhat about, someone has cataloged 32 of these vidyas. And again, it is an image where one ponders this and then finds the deeper level. One ponders mentally, creates the image of the chariot, the self, luminous self, as the chariot, in the chariot, the buddhi as the charioteer, the mind as the reins, the senses as the senses as the body. And the heart of the presentation now will be, what actually is the nature of this Atman? Usually, it has been translated in all these texts as the self. I have a little trouble with that particular translation because it is too a separate. It poses as individual as opposed to other individuals, an individual self. But the idea of these Upanishadic sages is that this self, this self-consciousness in the individual, is in essence no different than the ultimate reality that is life. This is a prime point to grasp. The word itself, Atman, usually derives from an expression of to breathe. It is a living conscious thing. And in fact, in the older Upanishads, the word prana is identified as this eternal self, prana being a form of breath. In fact, there are different stages and different distinct uses of the word prana in these texts. There's prana, those of you who are familiar with yogic texts, there is the prana that are the five movements of the breath, a prana exhalation or forward breathing. There's the apana, the inhalation. There is a vyana, the thorough breathing, udana, upward breathing, the samana, central breathing. So that is one form of prana, literally the circular breaths, literally the circular breaths in the body. Again, there is also prana as the ruler of the senses. There is a wonderful tale that's told in the Upanishads of a battle among the various senses in the body to decide who was the ruler of this body. The body is a host of all these different senses. They decided who was the real ruler of the body. And so each of the senses decided they would leave the body for a year. Sight left for a year, and the body wandered around as a blind person, came back. Hearing left the body for a year, and it wandered around deaf. Speech left the body for a year, it wandered around mute. Different faculties left. And then finally, as prana was going to leave, they said, no, no, because when prana would leave, the body simply would die. So prana is usually looked upon also as the ruler of the senses. Then there is also prana as the sense of a vital breath, not just the physical breath, but a form of energy. And then finally, prana identified with Atman. In fact, the Prajnaparinishad says that prana springs from the self. Inseparable is prana from Atman, as is the shadow and he who casts the shadow. And the example is given in the Mandukya Upanishad of two birds, both fast friends, who sit perched on the same tree. One is eating a delicious fruit while the other watches on. These two are related in the sense also the Atman in the body and the different functions, the buddhi, the others, can be seen as emanations. They are not simply distinct entities, but they are emanations of the same thing. The whole Upanishadic world is remarkably whole. It is not a world of so many separate entities, but different entities that are different stages or grades of the same thing. As the mind is purified, On another level, it takes on a different term, a different meaning. In dealing with this, again, prana, this form of breath as an energy, and you can understand with this meaning of breath being so important in the Upanishads, and in, it comes in, of course, in later yogic practice, which is, you know, a great part of yogic practice, is this breathing, is this regulation of the breath, is this creation of certain energies. And there is actually a term in the Upanishads when prana is used in the same sense as Atman, and it's called Prajna Atman. Now, with these different selves, this Atman, this consciousness, you are familiar with the Gita that also uses this idea of the charioteer, the divine charioteer. Krishna, in turn, is the host, while Arjuna is the charioteer. And in fact, in the Upanishads, and perhaps really in the Puranas, they are often referred to as the two Krishnas. They are two different aspects of the same thing. In the Mahabharata, in fact, it says that the body of creatures is a chariot. Sattva, they call the charioteer. The senses, they call the horses. The mental organ of action, which is in Sanskrit karma buddhi, is the reins. Whoever follows after the rush of these running steeds, he turns about like a wheel in the cycle of samsara. Whoever restrains them with understanding, buddhi, restrains the restrainer, the charioteer does not return. This idea of buddhi as the restraining charioteer, these are all in turn aspects of the way consciousness is looked upon. In this, we find again the symbolism of this chariot, and I think this is one of the real great gifts that the Upanishad gives us, this strong image, which if meditated upon, which really probed, can be very revealing as a symbol. In the Kabbalah, there is the Merkaba, which is the sacred chariot, which you're familiar with, as I say, from the chariot of the tarot trumps. Philo of Alexandria writes in almost identical terms of our text, save that he is writing of the universal or macrocosmic chariot rather than the microcosmic ones. And in turn he says, so he that drives the chariot of the powers is the Logos, and he who is born in the chariot is he who speaks, the Logos, giving commandment to the driver for the right driving of the universe. Again, Plato also uses this image of the horses of the soul being a pair in the chariot. So, again, this idea, if you have this idea of the nature of this consciousness, I think this symbol of the chariot, I return over and over to it, because I think it gives us very clearly this idea of consciousness in one of our oldest texts, the idea of the self, but related to the body. The self not being separate from the body, but the different functions of the body being in turn aspects, and when they work together, they can really achieve the desired effect. You really can, in turn, drive your own karma if you are working all in harmony. And in fact, again, one of the Eastern scriptures declares that before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained. Before the soul can hear, the image has to become as deaf to roarings, as to whispers, to cries of bellowing elephants, as to the silvery buzzing of the golden firefly. And that before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto this silent speaker be united. As those of you who are familiar with my talks, they usually know that I like to take a break and then have some questions with the audience, especially those of you who may want some directions for the papers. I hope you will or will not contribute. So at this point, I'm going to open it up for questions. So speak now or forever hold your peace. And then we will continue. Don't all speak at once. Well? Yes, Marie? Well, I was hoping someone would ask that question. Go to the head of the class for that remark. I have somewhere a list of the various translations of the Upanishads. Upanishads were translated into Latin in 1801 by Anquetil du Perron. It is said that Sir William Drones actually did a translation of the Isha Upanishad as early as the 1780s in Asiatic researches, but the main translation was in 1801, 1802, and it's huge folio volumes in Latin, which he in turn translated from the Persian. And his translation is a very exact translation, a very literal translation of the Persian, while in turn the Persian is a very free and open translation, almost a paraphrase of what the Sanskrit was. There was a Dr. Rohr who did translations in about the 1820s, and this was reprinted some time ago by the Adyar Library. It's not still in print, but the library downstairs has it. The most famous translation, as you may know, is that of Max Müller, which first volume came out in 1879. He translated the major Upanishads. Theosophists, as you know, have done a great deal of work translating Upanishads. G.R.S. Mead has a translation. Charles Johnson, who married Madame Blavatsky's niece, has a translation, or more of a paraphrase. In the turn of this century, we've had Hume translate them for Oxford University Press. Radhakrishnan has a translation, which I think is one of the best that is suited for the person who is just being introduced to it, because he also gives a lot of corresponding terminology for the Christian Gospels. He manages to relate the Upanishads in his footnotes to not only the Gospels, but to other literature, a lot of other Western literature. G.R.S. Mead, as I mentioned, did a translation. Yeats did a translation that is very poetic. Christopher Isherwood has one in paperback. Juan Mascaro has one in Penguin. And of course, as we come closer to the 60s and 70s, we see that the translations have become really abundant. As I say, probably for the person who is just approaching this and really wants a coherent translation, Radhakrishnan's is good because he also gives you the Sanskrit in Roman text, so you actually see the word, you can hear the word along with the translation. There are a lot of the minor Upanishads that also have been translated. In fact, in the Theosophist in the 1890s, there were a lot of translations of these minor Upanishads, the Yoga Upanishads, many of the smaller and minor Upanishads. Recently, there's been translated into English 60 Upanishads of the Veda that was done by Paul Doyson in turn of the century, and that's been recently translated in India. I think part of it is to get an idea of what the words mean, because, of course, all of this is transmitted through speech, through knowledge. But that should give you some sort of idea. One of the best commentaries, if you're looking for a way to pad out your paper, is Paul Doyson's The Philosophy of the Upanishads. Even though it was written in 1899, it still holds as a good introduction to the overall philosophy. And I think Doyson had a real love for the subject. He comes from that European tradition of Schopenhauer. You know, Schopenhauer read the Upanishads in Latin and said they were the light of his soul. So Doyson's Philosophy of the Upanishads is still a good introductory to the overall text. Radhakrishnan gives some points, but I think if you have that, and then of course it's important with these texts to extrapolate on them. It isn't simply a reading and then taking what it sends, or else you end up like the Asuras in the text. You simply take it for what it's worth, and you don't pursue it any further. And the thing with these texts, like all esoteric texts, is that the more you pursue it, the more you get out of it. And in turn, you can take it. There, like all esoteric texts, there are many levels to the text itself. The discerning student, I've known people who spent their lives in India simply working on one particular text and still claim that every time they go back to it, it gives them something deeper, it gives them something more, like all true esoteric texts. Yes. D-E-U-S-S-E-N. And in fact, those of you may be familiar with Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell did one of his first publishing jobs by editing a student of Doyson's who did his lectures at Columbia University and produced a book on Indian philosophy, which is one of his first editing projects. But Doyson is, I also prefer Doyson's translation of the Upanishads, which has only recently come into English, even though they were done in something like 1894. And because he gives you not only the text, but the background. The Upanishads, as I mentioned, were connected. They're not simply separate works, but they relate to the other works. They relate to the Aranyakas that precede them, which in turn deal with a more symbolical way, which in turn deal with the Brahmanas, which in turn are the ritual texts, which in turn deal with the hymns. And in fact, some of the Upanishads are a continuation of the Aranyakas. An example is the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. In ancient times, a horse would be let loose to run for a year. And at the end of a year, wherever it traveled, the Raja or king, the area it covered, would be regarded as territory of the Raja or king who let this horse go. If you challenged it, they went to war. If not, the person acceded. And this horse was usually sacrificed at the end of the year. Now, for instance, the Aranyaka to this text, or the ritual, for instance, gives a more symbolical approach. And the horse, in turn, its sun is its eye, the year is its body, the moon is its, the wind is its nostril. So they take up a more philosophical view of the really hard ritual text. And in fact, we see this trend in the Brahmanas themselves. Example again, how things progress, this gradation of change. In the Shatapada Brahmana, which is in the Yajurveda, they give an example of, at first, the gods offered up a man as a victim to the sacrifice. And when he was offered up, his sacrificial essence went out of him. And in turn, it went into a horse. They offered up the horse. When it was sacrificed, its essence went to an ox. They offered up the ox. It went out of the ox into a sheep. When they offered up the sheep, it went into a goat. When they offered up the goat, it went into the earth. Then they searched the earth and found rice and barley. And since that time, the text says that they offer, instead of these actual animals or sacrificial victims, they offer this rice and barley as sacrifice. As I say, the Upanishads themselves offer this really unique way of looking at the world, considering that the age of these texts and how much different they are to the religious texts of the time. It seems odd that the theory has been that, in turn, the Aryans, and the term Aryan is not used in a racial sense, but in the sense of those who perform this fire sacrifice were considered Aryans. The term is usually translated as noble, but it is usually used in the sense of simply the Aryans were those who performed the fire sacrifice. Those who did not perform the fire sacrifice were regarded as not Aryan. And in turn, it seems odd that after somewhat, say, 1,000 years of invading this country and coming in and conquering and becoming landowners, they should suddenly decide to leave the world, go into the forest, and start speculating on these matters of reality, when in turn a culture usually is at its peak. They really want to know more about the world. And it also has been suggested in turn, these Upanishads represent to us the real esoteric traditions of these Harappans that the Aryans came upon. When the Aryans invaded and came into India, these people, the priests, left the towns and retired into the forest. And in turn, that these texts, these forest texts, represent really the centuries, the millennia of their speculations into these deeper matters. And in fact, we have the example of Alexander, when he got to India, goes to see, according to his biography, goes to the forest and meets these sages who in turn talk and tell him the meaning of these different secrets. So perhaps also the age of these texts is actually deeper. The Upanishads have been tremendously influential in our own time, influencing a great deal of modern movements because of their way of looking at life, where, as I say, the individual consciousness, Atman, is not considered separate from universal consciousness. Usually Atman has been described as the self, as so many ball bearings, for instance, as separate things, but this is not the way the Upanishads describe them. The example is given as sparks in a fire, this is, as Atman is to the universal flame. And perhaps we can think of this consciousness, the individual consciousness, Atman, is at the highest moment its understanding of its full potential. The equation is usually that Atman is Brahman. The Atman is the universal self. The individual consciousness is or can be that universal consciousness. So perhaps this Atman is in turn the realization of the ultimate potential in every individual. As it is explained in one of the Theosophical texts, that this hidden life vibrant in every atom, this hidden light shining in every creature, that this consciousness is something that we all share, not that there are so many Atmans floating around in the world, millions of Atmans, but there is this unifying, this unity of life, which in turn has become tremendously influential in our own way of looking at the world after thousands and thousands of years. Yes, anything else? Ask your questions now because I will not be here again. So take advantage of it, yes. Now this has been a problem. I did a seminar in Madras, the Indian Institute of Asian Studies in Madras, and the theme was Buddhist themes in modern Indian literature. And my theme was the Theosophical contribution to the Buddhist revival in India. They choose these themes for you and you have to do as best you can. And it was mainly vice chancellors and professors, and one of them, after I gave my talk, he said, how do you justify the Theosophical idea of a separate self, a higher self, with the Buddhists who don't believe in a self at all? They're in southern Theravada Buddhism anyway, they believe in anatta. There is no eternal separate self. Well, I suggested that he ask the Dalai Lama, who in turn is regarded as an incarnation of these many selves than myself. But I think that the idea is that Atman itself, if we look at it as a universal thing, that if we look at it as a separate thing, that each individual having the separate Atman, I think this is what the Buddhists in turn would go against, that there is a separate eternal thing that does not change, meanwhile, while all reality is a constant unfolding and unchanging. So if you look, though, at this, the Atman, as the Brahman, as this thing seeking, as Kant would have it, as the world soul seeking expression, as this thing seeking fulfillment and expression, it's no longer looked upon as a static thing. Though the Atman and Brahman may have millennia, has yugas in India, they have yugas and Kali yugas and huge time periods for fulfillment, which I guess explains why nothing ever gets done there, where everything is always put off till tomorrow. It's interesting that the Buddha, in turn, didn't really deal with a lot of subjects. As you know, he dealt mainly with suffering. And there's a wonderful story in the Milindapana where King Nagasena goes to Milinda and asks him about this question, this very question: what is the nature of this self? And he replies that whether the self exists or doesn't exist, suffering exists. You know, so the Buddha in turn dealt with more immediate concerns. Whether Buddhas arise or Buddhas don't arise, suffering exists. And there is a way of liberation from suffering. So he didn't really deal, according to at least the Theravada Buddhism, with all these different speculations after death, a lot of things about the nature of this self. But what he did rail against is the idea of an unchanging, separate entity within each individual. This is definitely called anatta, that there is no abiding, separate principle in each person, which in turn creates division among peoples. If you have a higher self that is separate from everyone else, there is this division. You cannot really have that unity of life. Though again, if you believe the Mahayanists, his famous simile is that he picked up a handful of leaves from the forest and says that this much I have revealed, as much as in the forest floor, that is still unrevealed. The Buddha, of course, grew out of that whole world, and it's interesting that Madame Blavatsky's thesis that he actually revealed what was only communicated to the priests in the sanctuary, he revealed this to a wider audience, is really interesting in relation to the new discoveries that we have about this older civilization, which, as I say, was totally really unknown until the 1920s when they began excavating. Unfortunately, with the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947, Pakistanis are not so interested in showing the ancient history of Indian culture, so that has been sort of put on the hold. Yes. This there is a pocket that exists in the north that is called Brahui. Perhaps John can enlighten us on this. The Dravidian languages, of course, are the languages that exist in the south of India, Telugu, Tamil, Kannada, Karnataka, in those areas. And they are not related to our Indo-Aryan languages. There's a big question of where they originated. And before the last century, since Finnish is cognate with them, it is thought that maybe these South Indians actually immigrated from Finland and ended up somewhere in South India. But there is this little pocket that exists in the same area where the Harappans had their culture, and it is known as Brahui. It is a tribal language, and it is akin to this Dravidian language. And the people who are actually doing the most research in the field of Indic studies, at least Rig Vedic studies, are the Russians and the Finnish. So, of course, they feel that perhaps this is a remnant, a relation to them. It has also, there's been various attempts to break this Harappan script, and no one seems to have been able to do it. The latest attempt was to take all the characters that exist on these seals and run it through a supercomputer, and again, the results have been inconclusive, though, of course, some claim that it was perhaps a proto-Dravidian language. So cognate being, it is related, perhaps, to Finnish. Finnish would be one of the languages that would come close to this tribal language called Brahui. It seems odd that in the midst of an Indo-Aryan language group, you would have a very small pocket of a language that is related to the South, and where there has also been speculation that in turn, as the Aryans came in, they drove these people further and further and further to the South, and their languages exist, their culture exists in the South. I'm glad that I had a professor at Columbia, Professor Emery, who had actually taught in India, and he said that when he went to India as a young teacher, he asked the headmaster of his college what should he do when Indian students ask questions, and the headmaster said, if they're good, they won't ask questions. So I'm glad to see that you are all in that level, that you are all so, that I really have nothing to teach or inform you, that you have taken all of this in.
One other thing.
Yeah.
Were you making the suggestion that there was an older culture involved there before Hindu or something?
Well, we know that this culture exists. We know that it's very old. We know that it is of the time period of, say, Ur of the Chaldees, that they did have trade between these areas. And as I say, though a large amount of archaeological evidence exists for this culture, no linguistic evidence exists. While for the Vedic texts and the Indo-Aryan texts, we have a lot of linguistic texts, but no archaeological evidence, which is strange. But we do know that now the view is that actually this culture is the culture that contributed really to Hinduism as we know it. Hinduism is actually a very modern thing. Again, Madame Blavatsky very correctly identifies what existed at the time of the Buddha as Brahmanism. It was a religion of the elites. Hinduism nowadays, anyone can participate in it. There is no congregational worship as we have in the West. Going into the temples, you find a flow of people going in, going back and forth into the temples to do their own individual worship and puja. They don't have that congregational worship as you would find in the monotheistic religions, as in Islam or Christianity, or as in Judaism. It is really believed that in turn, this older culture actually contributed to what we know as modern Hinduism. Again, tree worship, snake worship, worship of stones, worship of meditation especially. The whole yogic practice is believed to actually go back to this ancient culture. Nobody in India really does the fire sacrifice as the Vedic priests do. No one would have the time of building fire altars. In the Vedic times, the populace didn't really participate. The priests did all the ritual, and they were the intermediaries between the gods and whoever wanted that ritual. The individual himself didn't really do all the ritual. He had the priest do all the ritual work, perhaps because they were the only ones who had the time to read all these texts. And in the Rig Veda itself is 1,017 hymns. Imagine, and all of this is committed to memory. And then the way it is chanted, the different forms, when a certain amount of fuel is poured into the fire, what one says mentally, what one says physically, what one imagines. So it is really suggested that this older culture, the Indians, of course, love to feel that their culture is an ancient culture. When I was at Benares Hindu University doing some research there on a theosophical college called the Central Hindu College, I went to see the vice chancellor. And these Indians will always have a lot of people, you know, doing work around them, while people will constantly be going into their office. And he was signing forms, and as the head of a university with signing forms, talking to people. And I waited my turn, and I said, you know, I was interested in finding some information about this college that was started in 1898. And I said, I know in your culture, 100 years is really next to nothing to a culture that is really, you know, 2,000 years old. And suddenly the man, vice chancellor, sat up and he said, 2,000 years old, our culture is 6,000 years old. So they like to see that the Aryans invaded and India absorbed the Aryans. The Mughals invaded and India absorbed the Mughals. The British invaded and she really has absorbed them. All that exists of British culture perhaps are the railways, the bureaucracy, and some old buildings, and of course the language. So this blending into Indian culture, but the feeling has been that this ancient culture, first known as the Indus Valley Civilization and now known as the Harappans, really contributing an enduring strand to Indian culture. Perhaps when the Aryans came in and it submerged, it was still being practiced. It was not totally eradicated through, as I say, yogic cults, through different meditational cults, where one could go to the forest and do it. And really, it relied on individuals as opposed to a lot of priests. And these are the things that survived. And it's ironic that these are the things that have, in turn, invaded the West. So perhaps this Indus culture and this Harappan culture is more influential than we know. And one of the reasons I wanted to focus on the Upanishads is that it offers us one of the oldest examples of this way of looking at life, which is a very modern way. A lot of the concepts in the Upanishads have been absorbed in modern esoteric groups and in modern cults. I hate to use the word, but in a lot of modern groups, they are simply giving you a rehash of the Upanishads, and better to get it from its source than second, third, or even fourth or fifth hand. Yes. It goes that before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained. Before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained, and fleshly eyes be rendered blind to all illusion. Before the soul can hear, the image, it says man in the text, but we've left that part out. The image has to become as deaf to roarings as to whispers. And before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united, just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united in the potter's mind. For then the soul will hear and will remember, and then to the inner ear will speak the voice of the silence and say, if I smell flowers, well, anyway, it is in the voice of the silence, and I'll page two, okay? Page two. Just before we close, I want to leave you with, even though, as I say, these Upanishads gave this philosophical view of looking at the world, toward the end of the Vedic era, this sort of speculation has started to creep in. And in one of the Vedic hymns, Mandala 10, number 129 in the Rig Veda, which is one of my favorite, there is this wonderful hymn to creation, which I think is perhaps a fitting way to close our investigation to the vision of the Vedic seers. And it begins, this is, non-being then existed, not nor being. Again, this is their language. Non-being then existed, not nor being. There was no air nor sky that is beyond it. What was concealed? Wherein? In whose protection? And was there deep, unfathomable water? Death then existed not, nor life immortal. Of neither night nor day was there any token. By its inherent force, the one breathed windless. No other thing than that beyond existed. Darkness there was at first, by darkness hidden, without distinctive marks by all this water. That which, becoming by the void, was covered, that one by force of heat came into being. Desired entered the one in the beginning. It was the earliest seed of thought, the product. The sages searching in their hearts with wisdom, found out the bond of being in non-being. Their ray extended light across the darkness. But was the one above, or was it under? Creative force was there, and fertile power. Below was energy, above was impulse. Who knows for certain? Who shall hear declare it? Whence was it born, and whence came this creation? The gods were born after this world's creation. Then who knows from whence it has arisen? None knoweth whence creation has arisen, and whether he has or has not produced it. He who surveys it in the highest heaven, he only knows, or haply he may not know. So thank you for letting me expound on this subject. I hope in turn that you'll perhaps